Okay, thanks very much for the invitation, Rachel. Thanks very much for having me here. So my talk is a bit more generally, I guess, about the way we use and can use the case of psychopathy for certain interests in moral philosophy. So my main interest is in moral psychology and the idea that we would like to know what makes us moral, and I need to explore this term a little bit more. We'd like to know what kind of capacities we need in order to be capable of morality. And I think that psychopathy is interesting as a psychopathological case because, as we'll learn today, obviously, and most of you know already, people who suffer from this personality disorder, again, we need to be talking about this a little bit more, but people who are psychopath or deemed psychopath obviously have some problems, very broadly speaking, with moral capacities. So what I like to do, and that's a more general agenda if you'd like, to use psychopathy as an example, or a real life example, of people who are somehow impaired in their moral capacities, and to use that as a kind of a negative template, almost, to find out what normal capacities we need as human beings in order to be capable of morality. So that's the general, and that's, I should say, a long-term interest of mine. So I'm not only, I've worked on psychopathy for some time, published on that, but I've expanded this interest to other psychopathological cases. One I could talk about, but I don't today, is autism spectrum disorder, where there are different but also some problems with moral capacities that are interesting to study, I think. So that's the outline, why it all, and I've already talked a little bit about that, why should we be interested as philosophers in psychopathy. That's obviously just one interest that you can have, that's my interest. So to see psychopathy as an example of impaired moral agency. I don't know if someone wants, Then a little bit about what psychopathy is, because some of you might not know much about it, and again, I'll be very brief, and maybe some of the other speakers will touch on that as well. Then I'll highlight some problems, because psychopathy has been used in philosophy numerous times now. I think we have to be wary of certain problems in using those examples. We have to be clear of what we're talking about. It's not just a straightforward use we can make of those cases. Then a little bit more about my specific interest. The notion of moral agency is one that comes up. I don't really give a definition of that. I try to explore a little bit more what I mean here, and I have later on I have like a scheme of what I mean by that. Again, this is maybe something also for discussion, because this is something that's still very much in development. And then my focus in the past specifically, and also still ongoing, is on empathy. You'll see that empathy seems to be the specific impairment that psychopaths suffer from. Okay, so that's just the outline. So we start with why even talking about this, and like I said, I've already talked a little bit about that. Psychopaths seem to be impaired in their moral agency, in their moral capacities. We might want to, or be able to learn something about about our normal capacities that enable us to be moral by studying those examples. And of course, it's interesting that these are real-life cases, and then we can have empirical findings on what is actually going on, as it were, what the deficits really are, what the impairment those psychopaths suffer from really are. So in other words, you can have a empirically informed theory of moral capacities. That's at least the aim. Now, empathy, I'll come back to that. That seems to be one of the main deficits of psychopaths. They have problems with empathy, but in a specific way. Again, I'll come back to the notion of empathy, because empathy, again, is sometimes misunderstood. It's not a clear-cut notion, and we have to have a philosophical debate on what we mean. And that's also related to somehow to empirical studies as well. But this is the kind of thinking used almost like an inference to the best explanation. Okay, so there are some people who suffer from moral deficits, What is their, as it were, the capabilities that they that are impaired? Well, at least one is empathy. So therefore, it seems that empathy plays at least some role in the development of moral capacities. That seems to be a straightforward and normal way of thinking. I should say a little bit more later about in the idea of enabling moral capacities. I've put in brackets here to a normal degree. Obviously, as philosophers, we often like to say, okay, there is a lack of something, and therefore it's a necessary condition, for instance, that empathy is present in order to be morally capable. I've become much more cautious in that respect. I think my claim would be in the development, psychological development, during the maturity, as it were, of moral capacities, if empathy is impaired, then somehow moral capacities will also be impaired. There are ways, and we know that from other mental capacities, to compensate for certain impairments. So I'm not claiming psychopaths are never capable of any moral action. I don't want to say that, or moral judgment or anything like that. So it's much more cautious, I think, my claim that I want to make. Okay, and that, of course, potentially leads us to a kind of a model for researching psychopathology, specific psychopathologies, in relation to an interest in specific questions of moral psychology, namely, very broadly speaking, what makes us moral. That's the idea, and that's the kind of the research project that I'd like to pursue. Okay, so just looking quickly at the Hare psychopathy checklist. So a few words about psychopathy. So psychopathy is not a part of the official psychiatric classification system. So you don't find the term in the DSM. There is now, it's a bit more complicated than that. There is some references now to psychopathy, but it's not the term that psychiatrists normally use as a kind of a diagnosis. Now what happened was that sort of very severe cases of what we call antisocial behavior disorder have been called psychopathic disorder, or psychopathy for short. And Robert Hare, a clinical psychologist, coined that term and used a checklist in order to find out the people are that suffer from psychopathy. Now what happens, and he almost insists it's not a clinical diagnosis, but it's still a way to single out, as it were, to find out whom of those people that we deal with, like for instance in forensic psychiatry, people who committed serious crimes and so on, are actually psychopaths. Now what happens is that people who are trained in a specific interview talk to those people, and they classify people along these, and these are not all of them, but along those factors. So you get a 0 if the factor is not present, a 1 if it's somehow present, and 2 if it's clearly present. Okay, so that's like a scoring system, okay? So you've got, like, say, grant yourself self-worth a lot, 2 points, okay? And that's an interview that you conduct with those people. Lack of remorse or guilt, and so on. And obviously, I don't need to highlight that, I guess. There are several items here on the list which are very problematic and very unclear to what exactly they mean. Just think of, what would be the one that I'd be very much focused on: callousness and lack of empathy. So what exactly would need to be present in order to score, say, a 2 for callousness, lack of empathy? I mean, obviously these people are trained and there are handbooks and so on and guidebooks, but it's still clear that there is a bit of a problem here in terms of the terminology, say, parasitic lifestyle. Okay, so what is that? And then, of course, the traits not correlated with either factor, they're even more problematic: criminal versatility. Anyway, so you score on those items, and if you've got more than, I think it's 25 at the moment, I'm not absolutely certain, or 30, then you're deemed psychopath. It's a bit more complicated because it's not in every country the same score that you need in order to be deemed a psychopath. Now, keep that in mind, because obviously when we do empirical studies on psychopaths, we need to, before we even study those people, find out who psychopaths are of those people who might be in the forensic clinic. So therefore, this is quite important, because that sets the scene, as it were, for whom we're going to study. Now, in philosophy, we find examples of people being very enthusiastic about psychopathy. I should say that their interest is a slightly different one than mine. I'll just give you a few examples. It's mainly in meta-ethics that are in certain discussions about moral motivation, for instance, a theory called internalism, another theory called externalism. One theory that claims whenever you make a moral judgment, you are also, in virtue of making that judgment, motivated to pursue this action. There might be, of course, circumstances that keep you from doing it, but you are, at least for a time, so motivated to do it. That's the idea of internalism. And there's also, of course, the long-standing debate between moral rationalism, moral sentimentalism. What's the basis of morality? Is this more like emotions, affects, and so on, or is it our reasoning capacity? And all of these two, as an example, psychopathy has been used as a kind of a test case for those theories. So we'll just give you the examples here. Adina Roski has said psychopaths are walking counterexamples to the substantive internalist claim. And she thinks so because it seems that to her that psychopaths are not at all motivated to act morally, but they can make moral judgments. Okay, so that would underline the externalist point of view. Jesse Prince more generally says psychopaths present an important test case for ethical theory. His interest is mainly in thinking about what kind of emotions are important for moral behavior. And Sean Nichols says the evidence on psychopaths so seems not to support empirical rationalism at all, but rather rationalism's rival, sentimentalism. So these are just examples of people from philosophy who use psychopathy and empirical findings for their theory of moral behavior and more generally moral motivation and so on. I think there are serious problems with that. Obviously, there are methodological problems. I've already highlighted that the idea of identifying psychopaths is fairly difficult. And we cannot just rely on the empirical findings just because some psychiatrists have said, for instance, okay, psychopaths make moral judgments, but they're not motivated to act morally. Therefore, I can use these empirical studies, for my pet moral theory in philosophy. That's just not feasible. But many philosophers do that, and I think that's a problem more generally with how we do interdisciplinary research in philosophy, I guess, because there are many other examples of where philosophers just use some empirical finding that they just pull out from somewhere, probably Google for it or something, and then they use it and say, well, there you go, there's evidence for my most beloved theory. You know, that's obviously not the right approach, especially not in the case of psychopaths. Now, there are also, this is more technical perhaps, there are certain tests, for instance, to judge whether psychopaths can make moral judgments. There's a common test of distinguishing between what is called convention and morality. So there are certain judgments that people are confronted with, and then they should assess whether this is a conventional rule, which can be broken under certain circumstances, or a moral rule that is, as it were, universally applied and that can not is absolute, as it were. And we do that with children as well. So children learn after a certain amount of maturity to distinguish those cases. Is it just because my teacher has said so, and that's a conventional rule, or is it something that you must never harm someone and so on? And the problem with that is that, of course, the very notion of convention versus morality itself is of some philosophical interest, and it's not clear-cut what is a convention as opposed to a moral rule, and therefore the findings that we use, the findings that we have when we use this distinction, when we ask psychopaths to draw such distinction, are again not clear cut. And of course, the unclear terminology as well. Okay, so basically speaking, generally speaking, it's not a clear cut phenomenon. We don't really know what we're talking about when we talk about psychopathy. It's, for instance, and that's more in my own interest now, what kind of a deficit is it really? What kind of an impairment? Is it irrational? Is it emotional? Is it affective? Or is it a volitional even problem? That's not clear-cut either. And you could probably speculate that there are many different kinds of impact that such a condition might have. course, we have certain philosophical commitments when we explore a certain thesis, say, for instance, about moral motivation. So just to remind you, internalists would say, whenever you make a moral judgment, in virtue of making that judgment, you are motivated to act accordingly. Now, what is it to make a moral judgment in the first place? So, for instance, if you claim psychopaths make moral judgments, for instance, they can say, well, I know I shouldn't kill or I mustn't kill anyone. I know that, but I just felt like it. So, is this person making a moral judgment because they can understand the difference between right and wrong? Do they really know the difference between right and wrong? Or do they have just like, almost like a sociologist perhaps, or an anthropologist, some information about what's the case, kind of a code, within a certain society? So is a moral judgment that implies somehow a kind of understanding in the sense that I identify with this judgment or endorse it or something, or is moral judgment just basically saying what is the case, what the moral code says within the society? That's not clear either, so we need to talk about moral judgment as a phenomenon, or what we would call moral judgment. Unless we do that, we cannot really discuss internalism versus externalism in application to psychopathy. So the result of that is empirical studies cannot offer proofs. We need to talk about our philosophical, conceptual assumptions, and of course we have to be careful how to use the empirical findings. So perhaps I can be a bit more quick here, because that's, again, with a little bit more focus on the empirical findings as such. We have to be careful here. We should be wary of the problems that when we read, say, an article in whatever journal of abnormal psychology or something, as philosophers, how to read that. We know, of course, empirical findings are often presented as if that's just the truth about something, but we know, of course, many empirical findings are contradicted by other empirical findings, and it's not difficult to see how specifically those findings here, the data and so on, can be challenged, if only because of the lack of, well, data in terms of finding psychopaths whom we can work with. Often the N in those studies, I mean the number of people involved, is very small. And that's just, again, ignoring even the problem of whether we can be absolutely certain that those people we have studied are really psychopaths, just reminding you of the problems of identifying them in the first place. I didn't go into the more official nomenclatura of antisocial or dissocial personality disorder. These are the terms that you have in DSM and ICD. There's similar problems with those than in the case of the Hare psychopathy checklist. Maybe it's also worth just mentioning that, for instance, the DSM, there was a huge debate before the DSM was published about 4 years ago, I think, whether the whole notion of personality disorder, which is the umbrella term for psychopathy and other disorders, actually makes any sense, and whether we should get rid of it completely. So there was a debate. It didn't happen in the end, but I mean, there is again some discussion about the whole vast area of personality disorder, not just about psychopathy. Then there is the problem, of course. So even if we talk about someone not behaving morally, we always need to ask the question, is that something that the person does by their own free will? Or is it something that they just cannot do? And of course, that's a very important distinction here, often put in this very broad notion of mad or bad. It's an important distinction because we might have people who just happen not to care about morality for certain interests that they have or so. Whereas here, especially for my own purposes, I would have to say I'm only interested in those people who somehow are impaired in their capacities and therefore are impaired in their moral capacities as well. And these are the cases that I'm interested in. I'm not interested in those people who just have some other random interest in behaving immorally in certain situations. And finally, this is just, again, focusing more specifically on the notion of empathy. We now have, what we often hear, that, like, for instance, here they have psychopathy checklist. Okay, so psychopaths lack empathy, but now, these days, you need to ask what kind of empathy, because we do distinguish now between different kinds of empathy. So that's, again, I think an effort that comes from both philosophy and psychologists, especially empirical psychologists, who develop differences between different notions of empathy. One is more to do with stepping into the shoes of somebody else, so taking their perspective, which is often called cognitive empathy, or perspective taking. Some people would say this is not proper empathy, but never mind, I mean, certainly called cognitive empathy. And it's a traditional idea, often to do with morality as such, that we think we need to understand the perspective of other people in order to develop the capacity to be empathetic. But it's also something called emotion, sometimes called affective empathy, and that is to do somehow that you feel what the other feels. And that's, of course, traditionally also involved with empathy. And then, of course, you can ask, but what specific aspect of empathy is missing or is impaired in psychopaths? Right. So, now, a little bit more about what I mean by more being a moral person, moral agency, and so on, because there can also be some misunderstandings here. So, this should be like, this is not what I mean, the first one. So, I don't mean that you always do what is morally required, okay, or even most of the time, because that could be called what many would call, that's like a conformity with morality. Okay? So I'm interested in the capacity. So I'm not interested in that people do this all the time. You could even have, it's probably unusual, but you could even have someone who's capable of morality and never acts morally in any circumstances. So always circumstances that somehow undermine this capacity to become reality or so. I also don't mean to say that a morally capable person or a moral person does the right thing on the grounds of the right motives. That would be a very Kantian approach, of course. So that would be, for him, probably what it means to be a moral person. You do it on the right reasons, right? That's a morally good person. What I mean is that you do understand moral considerations. That's why I often say morally capable person instead of moral person. Okay, so you don't have to act morally all the time, but you have to be capable to understand moral consideration, and you should be disposed to do the morally right thing, not to be morally different or to have a moral character. And these are different notions that are, as it were, you find in philosophy, in moral philosophy, when we talk about what it means to be a moral person. And I often relate this to the notion of a rational person. A rational person also has certain capacities to act rationally. This person doesn't always act rationally, of course, under any circumstances all the time. Still, we would call this person a rational person. So similar here, a moral person doesn't have to act morally all the time, or doesn't have to be a specifically good person or something like that. That's not what I mean. And I like this quote from Gilbert Ryle. Gilbert Ryle is interesting in that case. I once written an article on a paper of his 1958, published in 1958, on forgetting the difference between right and wrong. It's a great paper. And this is an even earlier paper. Most of you obviously know Gilbert Ryle from his book Concept of Mind, and it's undermining the idea of Cartesian dualism and so on. But this is an early moral philosophy paper that he's written, and I like this quote. So he says, conscience is not something prior to or posterior to moral convictions. It is having those convictions in an operative degree. Operative degree, I like that notion here. I.e. being disposed to behave accordingly. So it's not like, okay, let's find out what the capacities are, and then we just apply those capacities to something we call morality, and we somehow put it into our heads or something, and then apply this also. No, it's developing, as it were, in one go, perhaps. And, I mean, later on you'll see that I think we cannot, and most of you will probably agree anyway, but there's not such a thing as one particular moral capacities that somehow changes us. There are many capacities that we have that have nothing to do with morality as such, but that we still need in order to behave morally. So it's part and parcel of a whole vast array of different capacities that we have. And that, by the way, also undermines, and Ryle is very explicit about that, this idea morality is down to emotions or down to cognition or so, or rationality. He just says, when we do that, we departmentalize our mind into this sort of department stores, here's cognition, here's emotion, and here's maybe the will or something, this is a wrong way to conceive of our mind in the first place. So it's, as it were, a more of a package of capacities that together then enable morality. Okay. Now empathy is the one of the capacities that I've been interested in the past. I think it's a case in point because it's very straightforward that there is something with empathy that is connected to morality. It has a long tradition, of course, in many philosophical theories. Adam Smith, David Hume, at the time we didn't have the term empathy, they used the term sympathy, but again, that's more from a historical point of view. But empathy is a term that is, or a phenomenon that is important for morality. Now, in what sense, like I said earlier, that is something that we can discuss. I would now say it's somehow empathy as a requirement, empathy as a capacity is a requirement of the normal development of the capable to behave morally. It doesn't mean, I should say that explicitly, because sometimes again philosophers say that, I don't want to say that the actual sort of phenomenon of empathy in a specific situation, what we might want to call an empathy token, the phenomenon of feeling empathy, might some, in certain circumstances, undermine what is morally right to do. But what I want to say is the general capacity to act, to feel and sort of have the cognition of empathy is required in order to be capable of morality. So it doesn't mean that I want to say in every certain situation where I want to, where I should behave morally, there needs to be empathy present or something. It's a more general requirement of that I have the capacity. So emotional empathy seems relevant for being able to feel what it's like to be harmed. I mean, if, obviously I can understand what it means to be harmed for myself. So psychopaths, they can get very upset when they are being harmed, okay, so they're very angry about that. But what seems to be a problem for them is to actually feel what the others feel. So to somehow see people as feeling something that somehow resonates with ourselves. And we, of course, we do that all the time. If we see a picture of someone, I don't know, breaking their leg or something, right? So we feel their pain. Not in the same way, of course, okay? But we do feel what they feel up to a point. And that seems to allow us to a stance we call genuine moral care, so that we do understand what the other feels. But there are also what we might call more complex forms of moral agency, especially often there's a reference to fairness and justice. Sometimes, for instance, it's morally required to return an item that we bought or something, or we signed a contract. And what should that have to do with empathy? I mean, it's not that someone was being harmed or wincing or feeling pain or something, right? So it's to do with certain rights and so on. But there again, I think it seems to require that at least we do, that we are capable of this, taking the standpoint of somebody else. Like, what would it be for them not to have this item returned or something? Okay. So again, cognitive empathy seems to be required as well. Perhaps it's worth mentioning here that many people have said, and rightly so, that psychopaths seem to be capable of cognitive empathy because they can understand, in a cognitive sense, what is going on in the heads of others. How could they be sadists otherwise? If they couldn't see, as it were, understand in a cognitive sense that someone is now experiencing pain, how could they even, I mean, use that for their own interest, as it were, right? So cognitive empathy doesn't seem to be the problem that psychopaths suffer from. But that doesn't mean that they are also capable, at least to a normal degree, to feel emotional empathy. Okay, but we also are thrown back, as I said here, to an account of what morality and moral agency is. So obviously I think that has to go hand in hand. In virtue of discussing the psychopathological case, we also develop an account of moral agency. And on the next slide I have some kind of an outline of a scheme, perhaps, of moral agency that distinguishes different items that I think important. But hopefully you've now got an idea of what I try to say and what I'm not trying to say. I'm not trying to say that in every single instance the capacities that we are talking about need to be present, or sort of tokens of those, say empathy, need to be present. It's more generally like
almost like a Swiss Army knife, perhaps, where you have those tools and you have them, and you can employ them, but you don't have to employ them all the time. Now, Gary Watson, this is my starting point now, says a moral agent is an individual who can, to a significant extent, act effectively and competently in moral matters. So that would be like a definition I would like to use about moral agency. Here it's about the moral agent, okay? So the individual that has certain capacities, okay? And effectively, competently, that's also a term I would like to use. I often say normal, because I don't want to say that psychopaths are not capable of any moral behavior, but it's not normal in the sense that it's fully developed. So again, of course, that raises issues now of a kind of a normative approach, which obviously then relates to notions of health and disease, disorder, and so on. But that's exactly what I'd like to say. Okay, so that would be where I'm at the moment. So you would have moral capacities, that's on the left-hand side, and you have moral situations. Okay, so in moral capacities are certain capacities such as empathy, and then what I've put in here, further capacities. Well, that's very broad, of course, but yeah, there are certainly other capacities as well, and it'd be interesting to find out which capacities they are. I mean, empathy has been studied a lot, and I've highlighted that, and I've been interested in that capacity for a while. We think with cognitive and emotional empathy, and these are required in order then to develop, and that's obviously through, as it were, maturity, and normal development. And then we have what we call morality, and that's just a disposition to behave morally. And then, we have those further capacities that I haven't spoken about at all, but which are obviously also important, and I should only mention in here, these are probably some further capacities that we use for other purposes as well. I don't think it will be specifically moral capacities. Okay, and then of course we enter, as it were, a moral situation, and we, for instance, we assess a situation, we make a moral judgment, should I do something, should I not do something, should I abstain from helping, and so on. And there are certain influences now that are also important, that are also related to certain capacities that human beings have. We know these terms from, for instance, psychologists. So what they call, for instance, social scripts is interesting. So there are certain situations that come with, as it were, a whole raft of certain assumptions that are to do with the social situation and so on. We do have what they call biases, and it's a term that we now use in common parlance as well, of course. Then fatigue, so for instance, we talk about empathy fatigue. Okay, so it doesn't have to be empathy fatigue, it can be any fatigue. We might not be able to do certain things just because we're just, I don't know, we're distracted, we're not concentrated, we are just tired, we are upset, or whatever. So all kinds of influences that don't undermine our general capacity to behave morally, but we still don't act. But then, of course, there are certain situations where you would like to say, well, if the person cannot push themselves to do anything in such a situation, then maybe there's something wrong with their capacities again. But they are, as it were, strength of will, for instance, right? And then, of course, for moral judgment, there's also a step, another step to motivation, and we have, like I already said, certain influences here. Again, an interesting example from the psychologist would be what is called regulation. For instance, if you, as it were, overflooded, for instance, by certain empathy phenomena, then you might not be able to act. You might actually fled the scene. You might just disappear because you're just overwhelmed. You cannot cope with that. It's a very common phenomenon. So again, you need to regulate, you need to be able to regulate your emotions to a degree that makes you able to act in that circumstances to the degree that is required. And sympathy is another one that's more to do with being prone to see the other as someone in need. So that's more the, as it were, the activating component of moral behavior. And then we have moral behavior. And what I'd like to say is that I think in these different stations, or whatever you want to call it, in these different aspects of moral agency, we do have certain requirements on capacities of human beings that can be studied. Okay, finally, last slide. So I think psychopathy is a good example, a real-life example of impaired moral agency. It is interesting to study it. There are interesting findings, but we have to be very careful how we use those findings. I mean, I've had many problems, and maybe it's enough to just throw your hands up in the air and say, well, okay, we cannot really assess it. I wouldn't say go so far. I think we can find something out for our philosophical interest when we study a psychopathy and when we study the empirical findings, but we have to be careful. And I just obviously refer to some philosophers, I think, who haven't been as cautious as they should have been. I think what it means to be a moral person is to be enabled by a complex mix of capacities. It will not just be empathy. Empathy will be an important example, but there will be others. And of course, then you can expand the idea of studying psychopathy to other psychopathological cases where you find typically impaired moral agency, and then use this as a kind of a template to study the normal capacities that are required for moral agency. So at the same time, we need not just the empirical findings, because it's not clear what we mean by moral agency, and therefore we need to develop our theory of moral agency together with the findings that we have in order to develop a philosophical theory of moral agency. So again, it goes hand in hand, as it were. It's an interdisciplinary approach, of course, because you cannot do this as a philosopher alone. You need to study empirical findings, and you need to know what psychologists talk about and so on. And then you can, as it were, in this interlinked approach, you can develop a theory of moral agency that is empirically informed. And that would be the purpose of what I'm aiming at in my own studies. Thanks very much.